Lecture 9, The First Revolt of the Netherlands.
In the last lecture, we saw how, during the 1550s and 1560s, a series of disputes led to the formation in the Netherlands of a really powerful opposition to the legal sovereign, who was King Philip II of Spain. All of these disputes were either directly or indirectly related to the crown's efforts at centralization, fiscal centralization, political centralization, or religious centralization. But since it was the dispute really over the activities of the Inquisition in particular that provided the actual spark for revolt, I would like here to briefly review the issues which were at stake. No pun intended. As a devout and utterly uncompromising Catholic, Philip II demanded relentless prosecution of all Protestant activities. Now, although convinced Protestants were almost certainly a minority of the population in the Netherlands, this policy of persecution aroused really widespread opposition for a whole series of reasons, some of which are edifying, it seems to me, and some of which rather less so. On the one hand, many Netherlanders, actually including a great many Catholics, the bishops themselves protested, had a principled objection to the torture and execution of people for crimes of belief. On the other hand, many magistrates and political leaders were at least as bothered, perhaps even more bothered, by the fact that in 1544 the crown had assumed for itself all jurisdiction over heresy cases. Here the fear was something different. It was a fear of the loss of legal privilege, of an encroachment on the part of the crown on the traditional rights of local courts to try those crimes which had been committed within their own districts. Now, on top of these disputes over the Inquisition and its activities, tensions were further exacerbated by the fact that Philip left the Netherlands in August of 1559, leaving behind a regency government under his half-sister Margaret of Parma. Since the most difficult thing for any would-be aristocratic rebel to do was to directly confront or directly resist the king, the fact that the king himself was no longer there made it much easier to resist the government on the grounds that you were only resisting the king's wicked advisors rather than the king himself. Margaret's authority in the Netherlands depended crucially upon the cooperation of the so-called grandees, high aristocrats who monopolized provincial governorships and other important state offices. And yet, the irony of Margaret's position was that three of these grandees, Prince William of Orange and the Counts of Egmont and Hornus, were themselves the center of the opposition to Philip's efforts at centralization. In a sense, the crown was caught in a kind of dilemma which is actually archetypical of 16th century governance. The highest officers of the crown, though sworn to carry out its orders, were also led by their own principled convictions and less principled ambitions, and I think we have to say that both of these factors were at play in the Netherlands to destabilize the government itself. How then do we get to rebellion itself? Well, on the 5th of November, 1565, there arrived in Brussels Philip II's letters from the Segovia Woods. These letters ordered that the heresy laws be complied with in full, and the letters further ruled out any kind of moderation, any kind of accommodation whatsoever. The aristocracy was now therefore facing a pretty clear choice. They could either comply with their sworn duty, or they could openly disobey the king. And in the 16th century, political initiative almost always lay with the aristocracy. Some of these aristocrats had already made up their minds. In early 1566, there was a group of lower nobles, most of whom had fairly open Calvinist sympathies, who were usually called the Confederates. And they drew up a kind of document of protest. It's called the Request, and it demanded that the heresy laws be moderated. It's interesting that they never demanded that the heresy laws be abolished outright, but they only asked that they be moderated. The grandees, the Prince of Orange, Egmont, and Hornus, were being a bit more circumspect at this point. They weren't really willing to attach their names to the request, to sign on to it formally, but on the other hand, they also refused to enforce the heresy laws. They were sort of trying to hold a middle position here. On the 5th of April, 1566, 300 fully armed Confederates forced their way into the presence of the regent and presented to her their request. This crucially compromised Margaret of Parma's authority. For armed men to shove their way into her presence and, you know, in an aggressive way make a demand like this made it clear that she didn't have that much support among the aristocracy. And Margaret, therefore, like I said, was driven to compromise. She agreed to suspend the prosecution of heresy. Nevertheless, she still insisted that the public exercise of any non-Catholic religion still be prohibited.